Welcome, everybody. Welcome to our first meeting for the principles class in the pelvis, hip, and sacrum advanced myofascial techniques course. We're going to give everybody a few moments to make their way in. They're still being admitted, they're still joining, but as you're coming in, yeah, you're just making yourself comfortable. Make sure you're set up so that you can see and so that you can hear. You are muted as you come in, and we ask you to keep yourself muted. Juliet.
Okay.
Unless you raise your hand, if you want to say something or you have anything you want to say, just raise your hand, and that is at the bottom of your screen. In most cases, it's a little button or under your more menu where you raise your Zoom hand, and we will call on you if you need it. You can also chat to us if you need some. If you have a question or something like that, if you have technical issues, you can always type on the Facebook page or call the office. Tiffany's standing by to help you too. I'm going to continuously mute all. And again, you're going to start yourself with yourself muted if you would. Bruce Nelson is our mute master. You want to say hi, Bruce? He has to figure out how to
mute. Hey, everybody. How you doing today? Welcome.
All right. Lorraine, did you make it in the room? Lorraine got stuck in the waiting room somewhere. I'm still waiting for Lorraine. All right. So we'll you're here. Great. Lorraine is monitoring our chat today, and we'll be checking in with her along the way. So she'll be seeing what you chat. I don't typically see it right away. Wait for Lorraine to tell us that. But yeah, just making yourself comfortable as we wait for people to come in. Yeah. Now, while we're getting started, let's get my thing here going. This first call, you know, there's always a bunch of getting settled, getting to figure out the controls and stuff like that. But while we're getting started, I want to tell you about our designated good cause today. That's Kiva. Kiva is a micro-lending organization. They couple lenders with people that need a loan during this time that everyone's kind of either wanting to help or needing help or both all at the same time. I've been really restless and looking for something. They're not a sponsor or anything like that. This is not a paid plug. They're just something that I think is really cool. And while people are getting settled, I thought I'd mention them. I'll put a thing up on their line, Kiva. So you can Google them, just kiva.org. And then we have a team we've started there. We're going to try that to see if we can actually do a bunch of Kiva work together. Let me see if I can share my screen so I can show you the Kiva stuff while we're getting settled. All right, so you're going to see my screen. I'll start the presentation there. Yeah, that's what you came to. And this is Kiva. Yeah, again, they're a micro lender. As a lender, you get to decide how much risk you want to take. You're actually making loans directly to people. You decide what sector, what gender, people who taking loans out to do health procedures. They're taking loans out to, like in this case, keep their bagel business going, things like that. They're taking loans out to start farms or buy inventory. And they are all over the world, all over the place. They're pretty high repayment rate, but again, if it's important to you to get repaid, you can dial down your risk. It's also great for you as a borrower. If you didn't get the government help you need, or you need to take either no interest or low interest loan out, there's something to check out for sure. And here's what we're trying. We're going to try our hands-on therapists fund. So a fund that actually makes loans through Kiva, micro loans, super low interest rates or no interest rates. So check them out. And I'll announce this again at the end. But I know a lot of us are really restless and wanting to know how we can help these days. And this seems like a really great way. And then if you got the download, great, supplementary, not required if you didn't have a chance to open it up or look at it yet, not at all necessary, but there are some helpful links on the front page too, including, well, you're already here, so you know this, the link to this meeting and then the links to the Facebook forum where you can discuss and ask questions and to the office, et cetera, and individual contacts for the faculty are all there too. A little bit about getting the most out of today. Again, we have you all muted. If you have a question, You can raise your hand. If you can wait, I'll be coming back and asking for questions and answers. So it's better to save them up until I ask for them. If you have technical problems or anything, phone the office or chat on the Facebook page or chat to Lorene, who can help you. But as we get settled here, just a few tips about getting the most out of your day, most out of your course. Let's see if I can get my slide to advance, of course. That's the first way we get something out of our day. There we go. Avoid multitasking. Good reminder. It's so easy to check your email. It's so easy to find out, you know, what's happening in your stock report or go make a loan on Kiva. It's you know, so easy to do other things while you're here at your desk, your computer, your phone, whatever you are. Avoid that. Give this your attention. You know, there's things like doing dishes that will make a lot of noise for us if you do decide to come off mute. So just do this too, because that'll help the rest of us too if you do want to participate at all. We have a big group here, so that we are keeping you on mute unless we ask you to come in. Engage your body. That's the big one. That's the challenge, as it were, for those of us who are in this field, in the body field, to actually do this medium, this disembodied medium, and yet bring our bodies to it. Because it's so rich visually, there's auditory input, there's a connection with other people, but we're not necessarily using our bodies unless we remember to. So remember your body. Like right now even, take a big breath. Take a big inhale, take a big exhale. That was so good, let's do it again. Take another breath. As you exhale, let yourself sink into your chair even more. So it's like arriving into your seat. I know there's always a lot to do to get to these calls, and you did it. You're here now. So you can settle. You can rest into this place. If you're watching the recording, then you can do this as well. You can just settle. You can feel the base under you, whether you're standing or sitting, feel what's supporting you. And as we go forward, we'll be doing a couple little exercises that you can take part in, highly suggested. They're designed so that you can do them at your desk if you want to, but if you're set up in a way that you can spread out, use the floor, lay down, even better. And as we go, we'll figure out, again, how to best do this together. It may be, in fact, I'm going to suggest that next time you look at having a way to listen to this and do some floor work too if you can. We'll try to get on the floor during the next call. This call is going to be an option because I know not everybody was prepared for that. And engage your mind. Write your questions down. Think about what I'm talking about and say, do I agree? Do I disagree? Do I understand that? How would I apply that? Keep thinking about it. And this is the best one. Note your chest questions in the chat. We'll check in with that as we go. We will have Q&A breaks throughout the meeting. My co-hosts, Bruce and Lorene, will maybe jumping in if there's questions that they have or they think they want to transmit. So don't hesitate to chat those or save those for the Q&A breaks. And then we're going to have small group meetings, as you know, next Monday and Tuesday. We're going to have small group meetings where you can dive into the other questions that you're having along the way. And then in the meantime, there's the Facebook forum where you can ask your questions and discuss things as well. All right, so at this point, I want to check for any questions for clarification so far. Any questions for clarification? Raise your hand. We're going to practice that. I'm going to actually stop my screen share because that's what I got to do to see you. Yay. Cool. I see some people in the waiting room. I'll see a bunch of people in the waiting room. So admitters, there's like some admitting that needs to get caught up on. But I am going to... Yep, this is great. No questions so far, fantastic. I'm gonna go ahead and admit all. Yeah, that's the handy button at this point. Welcome, if you're just joining us, sorry for the wait. Some people got stuck in the waiting room. Yeah, admitters, looks like you need to stay on that. They keep filing in, so just keep clicking admit all at this point. But welcome, yeah, we're just getting settled. We're about to go back to the lecture. If there's questions along the way, you're gonna stay muted. We'll have question and answer breaks as we go. Okay, back to the slideshow. And where were we? We were here. Yeah. So we're avoiding multitasking, we're engaging our bodies, we're engaging our minds. And I want to talk to you some about the goals of this work, the goals of this approach. This is in your handout. Again, if you did get it and print it out, or if you got there on your screen, you can follow along. This one's at the bottom of page 3. This little following thing is at the bottom of page 3 in your handout. But if you've been in one of our in-person trainings, you know that this is how I like to start every class, is by just reviewing the goals. The goals give me a way to organize what I'm thinking and what I'm doing in my hands-on work. They give me a focal point and a way to understand what I want to see happen. Just a larger context for this discussion now, my goal here with you is to give you the background and contextual information you need to go learn from either our in-person workshops or our technique videos. Now, we did open it up. We did make both those things optional. We said, just come be part of this, even if you're not going to do those things. That's kind of an experiment. So my secondary goal is to make this useful, even if you never go take our training online or in person. That's the secondary goal. The primary goal is to help you understand more and go deeper with the techniques a lot of you have already been doing. I know we're well over 60-70% people have participated in these workshops already in some way. So there's a deep body of experience out in the group already, but some of you are just coming for the first time. First time you're doing something with me there too. So I'm trying to talk to that whole range. Now, back to the slide. This list of goals here are the things I think about when I'm doing this approach, the Advanced Myofascial Techniques approach. My first goal there is to increase options for movement, increasing options for movement, both gross movement and subtle movement. Gross movement in the pelvis would be most obviously the hip joint. The hip joint's the joint there with the pelvis that moves the most in the most gross sense. There's also a lot of movement at the lumbars and the lumbar sacral junction. And then the sacrum moves within the pelvis to some extent. Some of that's subject to debate, how much it moves or how significant it is. Pubic symphysis has some give to it. And there's lots of tissue movements around that bony frame. There's lots of gliding, say, or sliding or adapting. And on those local, very local levels, for sure, that's what I'm thinking about in my movement. How do I make sure that all those movements are available? There's options for them to do that. Now, options for movement implies also the option not to move, the option to be still or be stable. So that's, you know, one point along the continuum, options for movement. But the techniques I do, the assessments I do, and the interactions I have with my client are all designed around these basically two goals. This is the first of them. First one's options for movement, both subtle and gross. We got an animation. An animation of some movement of the sacrum. This would be the sacrum moving within the pelvic ring. And again, as I said, it's subject to debate. Some people say it moves so little it's not significant. Other people say, no, it moves a lot and it's really significant. And both sides of that debate have some fairly convincing evidence. So I'm not here to straighten out that debate as much as to tell you how I work with that in my own thinking, in my own practice. In the osteopathic tradition, that movement is considered really important. And Rolfing and Ida Rolf's work, which was my deepest, earliest training, really does come out of that lineage. And in that point of view, we really do look at what's possible in terms of sacral mobility and what the options are. This is an animation from Edward Moentinger. He's a craniosacral practitioner and a computer animator, lives in Switzerland. And he made these animations to show the movements that are considered to be normal in the craniosacral system. This motion is happening all the time in their point of view, right down at the sacroiliac joints. So Gross movement would be big movements that you're obvious and can see. Subtle movements might be small things that you really have to listen for, like the craniosacral rhythm. We're interested in both of those levels as well. In my work, I want to make sure the gross range of movement is an available option. And I want to make sure that the small, subtle movements that happen that might be just below my normal visual perceptive threshold are also available. Now I'm going to do that typically with my hands. Second goal. We want to do something. We're going to fill in this blank. We want to do something with the proprioceptive, kinesthetic, and interoceptive senses. So we want to do something with those. Those collectively make up our body sense. They're long words, a lot of syllables there, but basically what they're saying is we're doing something with the body sense. I don't know what you would fill in there, what word you would use. There's lots of things that people guess at when I ask people to guess. But what I'm saying is I want to refine their proprioceptive, kinesthetic, and interoceptive sense. I want to refine the body sense as a result of my work. That is a goal. Refining because it's the acuity, it's the ability to make fine distinctions and perceive things accurately that really makes the difference between a sensation that's pleasant or something I can work with and something that's not. The refining process ends up making things less unpleasant, typically. It's strange but true that a lot of our unpleasantness is a reaction to a sensation. It's a way we relate to it, perhaps, you know, contract around it, protect ourselves, withdraw from it, as opposed to being able to actually study it, feel it, turn towards it. Just that act of turning towards something, studying it, being with it changes the way we react to the sensation. And so it's one way that, say, pain gets reinterpreted or pain gets recalibrated when pain is the presenting symptom. All right, proprioception is our ability to perceive the position of our body. It basically comes down to joint position. Can I tell if my joints are straight or bent? Kinesthetic sense is, am I moving or still? The interoceptive sense, originally that meant essentially organ sensation. Am I hungry? Do I have to go to the bathroom yet? But it's come to mean more just inner body experience, inner body sensate experience, inner body sensation. So all those things together make the body sense. And with my hands, the techniques, with my assessments, meaning how we find out together what to work with, and with my interactions, the things we do together, I'm looking to refine that with the client in conjunction with the client. Now, this last bullet point here is really seen as a side effect of those first two goals. When I get those things, when I get the options for movement, when I help someone refine their proprioception, they end up with pain relief. They end up with less pain. They have improved function. It's easier for them to do things. They can move easier. They can move more. They can do more things in their life. And all those things kind of spiral and build into just a general enhanced sense of well-being. Things are okay. When you've got options for movement, when you have refined proprioception, there's a greater sense of well-being, greater sense of being resourced and having possibility in your life, which leads to that sense of well-being. All right. Opening up for questions. Raise your Zoom hand. It's a little control down at the bottom. A lot of us got to practice that in the intro. If you have a question at this point for clarification, raise your Zoom hand. And I am actually going to, I'm seeing that I cannot share my screen to see your Zoom hand. So, Bruce, are you able to see any Zoom hands? Bruce or Laureen? Going to count on you too.
I'm not able to see Zoom hands. I'm currently not co-hosted.
Well, we can fix that.
Same here. If you co-host me, I'll be able to help out.
You bet. I'm going to unpin myself. Thanks for your patience, everybody. We've all had to learn to be so patient with this online world as we'll figure it out.
Deborah's got a hand up.
Claire, do you see that? Do you want to go ahead and unmute Deborah?
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you. Deborah, go ahead.
have a question, I'm just raising my hand.
Oh, just like taking a Zoom stretch, raising your stretch.
Well, no one was raising their hand, and it seemed like maybe you weren't sure if anybody was doing that. But I know that in other classes I've taken, people have had a hard time finding the raise hand function.
Yeah.
And so that's on under participants, especially if you're using a phone, I think.
Oh, yeah. Great tip. Pro tip there. Look under participants, especially if you're using a phone. I see that David Corner has his hand raised. Claire, can you unmute him? I can see the hand raised, but I can't see where to unmute it. Cool. David, it sounds like you're unmuted.
Good morning. Could you, in the notes at some point, could you put up your sources for the research for this?
Yeah.
It looks a lot like Robert Schleip's stuff and some other sources.
Yeah, he's been a big influence. He was a mentor of mine. I taught with him, assisted him at the Rolfe Institute a bunch. I've kept a professional relationship with them over the years. So yeah, a big influence there. But I will name them as I go, David. But if at any point you're wondering about something, just the best way is probably to put it in the Facebook group or send an email, and I'll be happy to share that with you as well.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Pleasure. Okay. Any other questions right now for clarification? Very cool. All right, on with our show. I'm gonna go back. Yep, okay, so back to our show here. Another page in your handout. This is top of page four, if you wanna be in the paper version as well. The media, or the materials we use in our craft, or the means, it's not so much the means by which, but it's the things we work with, just like a sculptor would work with marble, or a painter would use oils or something like that. The media of our artistry in this approach really start with bones and joints. The bones are the framework I think about when I'm working. They're what I often feel for when I'm feeling for those options for movement or feeling for relationship. I often start with the bones. And the movement, the relative movement one to another, happens to the joints. So I'm often assessing and feeling and palpating what joints do, and then asking my clients to feel that and report as well. And if your background is in soft tissue work and you get in the classroom with us, you'll see that, yeah, it's a little different in that sense, that often we're starting with the stuff people with a soft tissue background aren't paying attention to, the bones themselves. Even though it's called advanced myofascial techniques, a lot of this approach really does start with the bones and joints. This is the first technique in that A sequence that even today focuses on the A sequence of the pelvis, hip, and sacrum training. The A sequence, I'll go through its general goals in a minute here, but it's this specific assessment that starts that sequence is an assessment of intrasegmental pelvic movement. And I'm not going to take a whole lot of time here and try to teach this online. It is explained in detail on the video. The notes there also give you the keys you need to use. I decided to go over, basically not to go over it today because it's a bit subtle at first. It's a great challenge to try to meet, but I figured here we're getting together in this context. Let's start with something that's a little more obvious. This one, though, you can feel intrasegmental bony relationships. It's a bony assessment. And begin to strategize your work based on that in conversation with your client. You can help them feel and help them sense what you're feeling as well. It's a great conversation starter. We are including myofascia in our media, myofascia being the continuum of muscle and its connections and wrappings, say the wrappings around individual muscular bundles, individual muscles, and groups of muscles, and their connections out into the rest of the body through the tendons and through the way their wrappings interconnect and interweave. There's been a lot said and written about that. In different modalities, it's given more or less significance. It's part of my heritage. There's a lot said about fascia that I probably can't get behind, but it's still something that I do organize my thinking around in terms of, especially the sense of interfaces, the interfaces between structures where movement happens. They tend to happen at fascial planes. And then loss of movement, loss of that option for mobility, often seems to be a lack of gliding or a different sort of viscoelastic property right there where the interface meets. And there's a debate, as you may know, in our field about how much manual therapy can actually change the physical qualities of fascia. That's a really interesting debate to me. And of course, my original training at the Rolf Institute, that's what we felt like we were doing. And there, you know, even the thinking has evolved, both within that discipline and without it, outside of it, to think, well, maybe there's a whole lot of other things going on, that maybe the changes we get don't depend on there being a physical change in the fascia per se. But one thing that helps me in my work, and one thing that I'm comfortable with in terms of the evidence base around, is the idea that the gliding, the interfaces between different structures, is something that we can change through our work, and something that I'm thinking about constantly as I'm locating the structure I'm working with and as I'm assessing the client's movement, for sure. One of these other meetings, I'll talk more about fascia. I want to dig into this question a little bit, like what can we say about it and what maybe we can't say about it. That's on my list. But today I'm just giving you the big picture tour of the media involved in this. For sure, we're thinking about the nervous system in this approach. There's lots of ways we include the nervous system. Here's an example from one. David, I think, mentioned Robert Schleip. He really picked up on John Cottingham's idea back in the 90s that maybe the Golgi tendon organs are a big player in the effects that we see in bodywork and what we feel with our hands. There's a whole lot of mechanoreceptors that could be responsible for what happens in bodywork. But let's just review for you really quickly the theory about how Golgi tendon organs might be helping our work. The theory says that as a tendon organ, which is basically a neural receptor in the tendon, is stimulated, it inhibits the motor neuron to that muscle. So when it's stimulated through pressure or stretch or combination, it actually turns down the resting tone of that muscle that's a part of. And you can actually hear that you don't hear it by putting your ear up to the muscle, but in laboratories where they're studying this, they put electrodes into the motor neurons, hook them up to an amplifier and a speaker so you can hear the firing rate of the motor neuron. It's a kind of static, because it's impulses that make a kind of static noise. When you stimulate the Golgi tendon organ through pressure or stretch, that static drops a pitch. It drops down. It's actually an auditory experience. If you go on Wikipedia, they have some of that, some fun multimedia about that. Just Wikipedia, if you wiki Golgi tendon organs, they have some of the actual recordings made from Golgi effect, Golgi research of motor neuron firing rate changes from the pressure there. So essentially, it's like a shortcut to getting the muscle to relax. It's another way to say it. When you press on the attachments, the muscle's firing rate lowers, and you're essentially dropping the trapdoor out from under the muscle's tension. It's a shortcut, so you don't have to go through and try to work the whole structure or the whole system. It's kind of like a magic press here and things happen kind of spot. There's a close-up on the structure of Golgi tendon organs where their neurons are laced in with the spiral collagen fibers throughout that structure. And again, the physical or mechanical forces get transduced into an impulse that has that calming effect on the relaxation. There, like I said, there's lots of other mechanoreceptors we think about. These are muscle spindles. Different layers have different sensors that sense different sorts of pressure, vibration, or shear. And then there's also nociception-free nerve endings that generate a signal that we can interpret as a pain experience. In a lot of our techniques, though, like this one, the push broom technique, which I'm going to go over a little bit today, I'm thinking about Golgi tendon responses as I feel for and hold into the attachments of the soft tissue structures on the bone. Again, more about that to come. And then there's something there that's more than the sum of the parts. there's something there that we're working with when we work with people that isn't just bone, myofascia, or nervous system, that I'm using the word soul to stand for all the other stuff. The stuff, the fact that we're alive, the fact that it's different when you work on a living body and a not living body, to stand for the fact that there's a sentience there, a sensing going on in our clients, and that that's an important part of the work, and a responsiveness and an experience. We're essentially working with an experience. That could be another word for this. But it includes the physical structures we're made out of. It includes the functions that we are. It includes probably what people are describing when they speak in energetic terms or in relational terms. It includes all those dimensions as well. And they maybe turn out to be the ones that are most important to our clients. Our clients want to have a different experience. They want to feel something differently. They want a subjective change. They want to feel better often. So including that in our thinking is really important. Hips. Good moment to pause and check in for Q&A. Quick questions for clarification before we get into hips. Raise your hand if you've got anything you want to ask at this point. Kirsten's hand is up.
Oh, Claire, can you?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, wait, I'm okay? You hear me?
Yeah, Kirsten, Claire, I think you're unmuted. So when you unmute someone, just tell someone they're unmuted so that they know.
So my question is the Golgi tendon. You're kind of talking about this like magical place where, you know, it releases the whole muscle. Does that always work, or like?
I can tell I'm going to regret saying that already.
Okay.
Is it always work? No.
Okay.
No. I mean, there's measurable effects, both in terms of the firing rate and in terms of the experience people have of focusing on attachments. But there's so many factors in there to what works. You know, in this case, we're just talking about relaxing the muscle. As you know, as a hands-on practitioner, you got a lot of tricks to help people relax, and sometimes you need them all, and sometimes none of them work. Yeah. So it's not like, but to say it's like a magic point isn't to reduce it to just like press here and the magic always works. It is to say this seems to be a really powerful and significant factor in all of the other factors we're working with. I like that answer better. Is that okay for you, Kristen?
Yeah, I kind of figured you'd say something along that line.
I
like,
know.
Really? Magic tricks until, I don't know.
I know. As soon as you think there's like something, like the one thing, it turns out, no, it's more complex than that. Okay, so some hands went up and now they're down. Claire, I'm in your hands.
Which one would you like? There's a question from Brandy. Unmuting you.
Yeah, you're in control.
You're unmuted
there.
Brandy.
Hello. I don't know if you can answer this right now. You didn't really talk too much about the Stork test today.
No.
But in taking this class before and in seeing it in print, you talking about when you're palpating the ischial tuberosity in that Stork test, you describe it as widening. Can you emphasize that at all? Maybe what you're actually feeling for with that widening?
Brandy, I hope you forgive me. I'm going to punt on that one. That is a really great question. And that's the kind of specific question about a technique that I want to redirect to just small groups.
Okay.
Or to the Facebook forum or any of the other places we can talk about questions. Because I haven't shown that technique or gone into that, you and I would have a really interesting discussion about that, but not everyone would be able to follow.
Okay.
So But as I go through and do talk about things, please keep bringing those specific questions back because I do love them.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, bye. Question from Scott. I'll unmute him now.
Hey, Jill, how you doing?
Great.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to confirm with the GTOs and how that just kind of, I kind of call it resetting the muscle that's connected to it. But when you place a load on that, does that also get the same result as well? Like an isometric type of thing?
Oh, as pressure? You mean like using the muscle and loading it through tension of the muscle contracting?
Right. So if they're engaging that muscle, yes. If they're engaging and I'm applying some resistance against that as like an MET.
Yeah, right. There's the math works out so that it's probably better to do both. that they need a fair amount of stimulus to even have a significant effect.
Okay.
And there's some debate about whether just pressing does enough. But it's clearly that if you, like you say, if you load it, if you actually contract the muscle somehow and press, then you're well into the threshold you need to have that measurable effect.
Okay, great.
This is theoretical. You know, this is like,
sure.
you know, someone calculating the math, which is imperfect anyway. Yeah. But there's a pretty good argument for something like having someone use the muscle, active movement, while you're holding the Golgi tendon thing or contracting, doing isometrics even, something like that.
Okay.
There's some good rationale for that.
Thank you.
And go ahead, Brian.
Good morning, Till. This is Brian from Los Angeles. Thank you for doing this. You know, you talk about, you know, the Golgi tendon organ and calming the tension of the muscle efferently. What about afferently? What can we do as therapists to calm the sensory, because that plays a part when in feeling pain and being able to relax the body? Because if they're tense and
we're
to work, they're fighting against us, and we don't know that the technique's going to work if they can't relax. And
that's right.
And you know, so.
That's right. What can we do? Well, there's so much we can do. You know, as all of us know, we're professionals. The receptivity of the client depends on the way we interact with them, the way our office is set up, the way they feel comfortable or not in the circumstances, the way we first touch them. There's so much we do to create that sense of receptivity, and that probably changes the input. You know, it changes the way they respond to what's coming in. And then the big tool we have starts with T and ends with H and has a OUC in the middle. That's, you know, our touch basically is what provides a sensory experience to people that feels good, that helps them shift their experience. Yeah. All right, I'm gonna go on now for hips. Thank you, everybody. Hips develop in a flexed position. When we're inside our mom, they're flexed, then we lose that ability to flex. Here's a gymnast working out with her trainer to regain that sense of flex. We're not going to try to recapitulate this on Zoom. We're not going to try to do this right now, but it's an amazing photo of someone getting stretched to get back their hip flexion that seems to get lost. This picture, I have no idea why I put it in the slideshow. But I haven't been able to bring myself to take it out of the slideshow. It's just too strange and good. But the page now in your handout, this will be, this is like, I didn't staple my hand out. Quick tip, staple your hand out. This is A1 on the bottom of page 4 in the printed handout. This is the goals and intentions for the basic sequence of techniques we cover in the sequence, the hip and SI joint sequence. The hip and SI are the territory, but then our goals for the sequence of techniques really are hip joint mobility. I'll talk some more about why and what that does. So number one is hip joint mobility. Number two is sacroiliac joint freedom and normalization. So freedom is, again, that option for movement or option for stillness. And normalization means that it feels okay, that it's not so overly sensitive or guarded that it just feels bad. So it's both, we're talking about in terms of those two goals again, mobility options and sensory refinement. Number three goal, rotator release. Rotator release, it's perfect for this territory. The word release, I should clarify a little bit, is another one of those red flag words that'll get people arguing in some circles, others not so much. But the objection some people have to the word release is that the physical changes that happen from our work are debatable. That this, the release suggests that there's actually some sort of letting go or coming apart or unbuttoning of one thing from another. And evidence is mixed about those physical separating and things like that that happens. And there's good arguments on both sides of that one. But let's say this, the evidence is mixed, that there's a physical release happening. When I say release, if it helps, and if you just get stuck on that, cross it out and put in mobilization or put in relaxation or put in eccentric lengthening, you know. Those are all synonyms, basically, for the way I'm going to use the word release. But no, I'm not arguing that we are unbuttoning one thing from another. Maybe. That was certainly a metaphor we used to use pretty commonly in this way of working. Yeah, I have serious doubts about it, but it's not something I'm thinking I'm doing, but I'm still releasing things in the sense of helping them be more mobile, having more options for movement, and feel differently as well. So the rotator release is part of our goal here. It's in the, right in the territory where we are. The indications, now this goes really quick, this part of the lecture, because there's only a couple here, but it's in some ways the most important part. This is what the client is experiencing that indicates you're gonna use these kind of techniques with them, the techniques from the sequence. This is the sequence you might pull out of your grab bag, or some of these techniques, it might be the ones you employ when clients complain of these things. Number four is you're getting ready for deeper pelvic work. You say, okay, this is gonna be a bigger project that I have to ease my way into. This sequence or these techniques are a great way to do that. Number five, hip joint issues. Hip joint issues, so it could be sensitivity, pain, movement restriction, etc. Sciatic pain, sacroiliac joint pain, and there should be one more in there, low back pain. That's really a key indicator for this sequence as well. I really got to put that in there someday. Low back pain belongs in this slide too, so just write it in. Sorry it's not in there this time, but next time there'll be an answer key in your handout. If you have the little class notebook that you got an in-person class or you ordered with your DVD, it has an answer key in the back. I'll put the answer key for this one in the next handout too, as well as then. So these answers are coming if I'm going too fast for you. Pelvis is a beautiful thing. This is George O'Keefe just ruminating on the amazing shapes that they are encountered within the pelvis. Yeah, this is someone getting some pelvic work that I use as an example of what we don't want to do. We don't want to be doing this with our clients in so many interesting ways. It's such a fascinating picture. For instance, we want to, you know, most obviously, we want to make sure our clients are comfortable with the circumstances, that they're feeling safe, they're feeling the privacy they want. And we want to make sure that we're staying in touch with them for all of this. So a lot of these techniques you're going to see from this, both the slides, but then when you watch the demo, they're working with areas that aren't socially in bounds in terms of how they're usually touched. So you got to get that kind of permission so that the boundaries can be clear and the boundaries change to that therapeutic modality, the therapeutic setting, so that you can make sure that your client is in that safe and receptive state. This is George Platt Linet from 1936, back when photography was coming into its own as a fine art form. But it just speaks also to the privacy of this zone. This is not a how-to technique picture. This is an artistic expression of the ways that privacy and intimacy and all those things are part of this. This is Man Ray, another famous American photographer, both of these two living in Paris. He's also using the human form and using the privacy around the pelvis to express, to have an emotional impact through just looking at this photograph. Elvis, you could say is the patron saint of the pelvis, perhaps. But he, again, with his belt buckles, with his everything else, managed to use the power of the pelvis to have his impact as an entertainer. Now, I mentioned back pain and pelvis. Here's Harvey Weinstein. This is Harvey Weinstein at arraignment, suffering from a lot of back pain. And again, places in the history of pelvises that are, you know, gone wrong. Not there. Somehow the things that we want to learn from in a way that in a negative sense that they're not going, you know, not going to do that. There's so much about the pelvis that again is worthy of reverence and worthy of respect and worthy of holding in a kind of, in a sense of sacred, that the, you know, the word connection to the sacrum is, some speculate, is related to that sacred bone. And in say the yogic tradition, the chakra system, the base chakras relate to some pretty important stuff So in a lot of different spiritual traditions or energetic traditions, that part of the body has a specific significance that you could say is a metaphor for the power of working in that place. So that's just, you know, in that relationship with the client, that means there's a certain reverence we need to bring and a certain therapeutic intentionality and clarity and listening and pacing that mean that our work is only effective to the extent that it's okay with the client and the client is participating and open to what is going on. So clarifying those boundaries, explaining what you want to do, getting overt permission, all those kind of things, super important. Can't emphasize that enough. Developmentally, the pelvis ossifies out of different bony structures. It comes together. It's still really mobile as a structure. The intrasegmental pelvic motions, the flexibility of that cartilaginous pelvis, is some what helps baby crawl and do all the wild stuff they do. But a lot of it too is their hip joints. They just have amazing hip joint mobility, partly from being in the womb and developing that flex position, but partly because they haven't begun to sit in chairs for too long and watch Zoom calls for days on end and lose that hip joint mobility. Yeah. So that hip joint mobility turns out does relate to back pain. So there's been some decent research. Here's a reference that correlates back pain and hip mobility. Turns out there's some pretty clear relationships between hip joint mobility. When you lose flexion extension, your back hurts more in both genders. That's what this is saying. The wording is complicated, I'm sorry, because I'm trying to say it accurately, to say exactly what the research found. But basically, it's saying hip joint extension, if you lose that, your back is more likely to hurt. Yeah, hip extension, more likely to hurt when you lose that, in both sexes. And then for men, when men lose the ability to internally rotate at the hip joint, and when they lose hamstring flexibility, then their backs are more likely to hurt too, statistically. Now, statistics, you know, an average, but it's a strong enough average that it is actually clear. You're going to have more people than not that have these tendencies. So when someone comes in with back pain, this is like one of the first things I think. How is their hip flexion extension? And for guys especially, how is their internal rotation? All right, here's me many years ago when I was had a better haircut, sitting at my couch. Look, it's not really me, by the way, working on my computer with my hips. I'm not taking advantage of my hip flexion. This guy isn't in this picture. He's rolling back onto his pelvis, so his hip isn't taking advantage of a full range of flexion. And yeah, as we can predict, your back doesn't get very comfortable. So right now, while you're on your chair, make sure that you're getting some hip flexion. You can lean forward in your chair. You can rock your pelvis forward. And you can do some hip extension in chair. You can roll back on your sit bones too, like he's doing in this picture. So that options, we want the full range, back and forth. And feel free to keep doing that as I'm speaking. That'll help you stay free from back pain and help you stay mobile as we go. Because when you lose those options, when you get a limited number of possibilities, like this gentleman does, he's basically got the same shape as the last guy. He's just had to pick it up and walk it around. Yeah. So when we lose that adaptability or those options for movement at the hip joint, it does end up affecting our backs. Okay, this is a review then. Yep. So this is, I put this in your handout because I figure it's worthy. It takes a little while to remember these. The short version is you want the hips to move if the back hurts. Now a lot of people's back pain gets better by just helping them get mobile in their hips. The pelvis balances on some femurs. This is a good moment, I think, to actually do a little movement break. So go ahead and get yourself situated so that you can, you could do this sitting, but I actually recommend changing your position now. If you can actually go ahead and stand up, or if your situation allows it, go ahead and lie down somewhere. But yeah, so you know, stand up, lie down, and then go ahead and do, let's start with hip flexion. So you can, I'm gonna see if I can show you. In fact, no, I'll keep the screen share going, that's all right.
hip flexion. So when you're standing, you can hip flex in all different ways. You could put your heel up on your desk. You can pull your knee to your chest. Maybe you want something to balance you, but go ahead and play with hip flexion for a minute while you're standing or lying down. You get to make it up. Yeah, keep going. Keep playing with hip flexion. Once you get some hip flexion, go ahead and breathe, because I want to see you. I'm actually going to look at you playing with hip flexion. That's great. This is cool. Finally, a use for gallery view. Yeah, keep, if, as much as it feels right to you, play with hip flexion. All sorts of different variations. You can also do hip flexion by stepping into like a lunge. The front legs, then is hip flexion. Yep. Breathe, relax, feel the flexion. Awesome. I see lots of great variations happening. People pulling their knees up, people on their back, et cetera. That's cool. And now let's go ahead and play with hip extension. So standing up, extension might be like getting some space between your feet and stepping into a lunge the other way. So the back leg now is an extension. It might be doing some of your fancy yoga moves if you want to go into extension that way. It might be, if you're kneeling, you can actually shift your hips forward. I'm sorry, this is not showing on my camera, but you get the idea. Play with hip extension and feel that in your own body. Yep. And make sure you get a little bit on both sides. You're just waking your hips up. You're also experimenting with, let's say, options. What options are available and easy to you? Which ones are more difficult? This is great. It's cool to watch. Yeah. Okay, so that's flexion extension. Now let's go to abduction adduction. So if you just shift your hips side to side, which by the way, this is gonna be our focus for our next sequence. Yeah, but let's just warm up our hips a little bit by going side to side. If you're standing, for example, if you're on the floor, you can windshield wiper your legs back and forth, etc. Abduction adduction, that's a really key thing. Yeah. And then rotation, I'm just clicking my slide forward so I can see it. Rotation, by the way, is gonna be like, you can stand, you can twist on one leg. That's one way to rotate your hip. That's closed chain rotation, internal and external. Or you can pick your leg up and rotate. Turn the other side. If you're lying on the floor, you can flop your feet in and out like windshield wipers. That's rotation of your femurs. Exactly. Okay, so then we're going to put it together. So now go ahead and take the leg that you want to give some more attention to and bring it to your chest. So this is hip flexion. Yeah. Then we're going to abduct it. We're going to bring it out. And then in this position, play with rotation. So you could do external rotation. You could do internal rotation. There's lots of things you could do here. Internal and external rotation. Awesome. In this flexed and abducted position. Great. Go ahead and put that down. Last bit on the other side, bring your other side up into flexion, abduction, and then play with external rotation, internal rotation, etc. Breathe, relax, feel. Great, you keep playing with that, make your way back to your chair in the next 30 seconds. I am gonna go ahead and check in with my chat thing, and we're gonna open it up to any comments, questions at this point as we get resettled into our chairs. Great, now looks like some people are having sound issues, but they're getting it figured out. Okay, good. In the absence of questions, I am going back to our slideshow. Let's pick it up here. This one is so, well, actually we kind of did that. Let me just show it to you one more time. This is the idea that the pelvis balances on the femurs. The femur is the support system for the pelvis when we're standing, and that all the soft tissues around that joint are what determine both the possibilities,
but then also the limitations of that arrangement. A lot of the direct and most local restrictions there are happening at the deepest ligamentous level. So this iliofemoral ligament and the various ligaments that are part of that joint capsule wrapped around there. Once the outer structures let go, you'll get to the place where those are being stimulated. You can actually feel the deep kind of stretch sensation that happens from these different motions, and it's probably becoming more adaptable. That's what I'm thinking about when I'm working and doing these techniques. I'm also thinking about those outer layers, some of the adductors, rotators, glutes, etc. The push broom A again works with all of these attachments around the hips. So there it is, push broom A. So it's a technique where we start in this position and take someone's leg up along their side like that, starting there. And then we take the leg up to the side past 90 degrees. That ends up feeling best. And then I use a static touch to feel for and press into the attachments of all of those structures that are crossing the hip. I tend to just hang out and wait here because that seems to be calming as well. But along the lines of the earlier question, I think it was Brian who asked about the contraction, there's an argument for that. And I haven't experimented with it much. This one's more of a, just a waiting and softening. Thinking about these Golgi tendon organs. That's what these actually are. This is a concentration of Golgi tendon organs within those tendinous attachments right in the bone. And then there's a sequence of variations where with the leg still off the table, I'll take someone into essentially external rotation. You can imagine that here, huh? So that it's the flexion, the abduction, and now external rotation. In each spot, pausing, waiting, breathing. To be honest, I'm thinking maybe Golgi response, but mostly I'm thinking stretch tolerance, you could say. Thinking, can I help this movement range be more safe, feel better? Can I help the body be friendlier to this possibility? So that includes both the physical effects it may be having, but especially the guarding or protective responses that are happening here when I take someone's leg, say, into a novel direction, novel position. Here's the next one in that sequence, push broom C. So here I'm putting her into internal rotation now. You gotta watch the knee, as the notes say there, and that's what I'm doing. I'm taking care of her knee, but then rolling her femur internally. Now this picture, it's on my list of things to change, you know, along with a whole bunch of other things I got listed. But the change I wanna make in this picture is I wanna have a picture with her knee up farther, because most everybody can do that. And I mean, like, seriously, most everybody can do that. Elderly, hip replacement, I'm going to say they can do this. And not because I'm going to push them there, but because it actually, once you roll the pelvis away from you and bring the knee up gently, they'll feel like it actually gets more comfortable when it's up here, even if it's somebody who has a fairly limited range of motion. So in almost all these cases, bringing it past 90 degrees, it's going to be more comfortable and allow you more options than stopping, which looks like here. She's flexible enough that I can just stop in pure abduction with the leg straight up the side. People are going to be different in their range. I'm not looking for absolute range. I'm looking more for relative shift or options, you know, or refinement. So here are two different pelvis structures in this photo from Joe Dully, he's the photographer. Paul Grilly, this is some of the information he uses in his yoga trainings, where he's showing how different people are in terms of just where their acetabular face. This person's face pretty far forward, while this one's right straight at the side. So their range of motion is going to look really different. Their feet are not going to necessarily point to the same direction when they're standing on the ground. And if they lie on their back, they may be falling in different angles than each other, but it's not like I'm going to try to make this person be like that person or vice versa. I'm looking for options in all directions here. Other just interesting bone changes
bone differences between people, angle of the femoral head, torsion of the femoral shaft. So from here, from this would be someone who almost looks like we'd call that an internal rotation of the femur. Well, guess what? It's a torsion just from the position. Their feet are going to tend to point outward. To this person, where they're probably going to tend to point, this person's going to point inward. This person's probably going to point outward with the joint still in a fairly mid-range position in both cases. So it's not trying to untwist the leg as much as help the leg move in all possible directions evenly, have all those options available. Those are the two extremes of that set of femurs that he collected. There's the push broom C where I'm internally rotate, and you can see that her knee is a little past 90 for sure. All right. So this is, I already gave you the answer, huh? So this is a little poll. Next time we'll figure out Zoom's polling features. It has some fun features that we'll work up to. The questions are, is it going to be less than 90 degrees of flexion, more than 90 degrees of extension, more than 90 degrees, et cetera. The most comfortable position is more than 90 degrees of hip flexion. That's the most comfortable position. And I harp on this, not because it's life or death, but maybe it's the difference between your client enjoying the technique and getting something out of it and just feeling kind of awkward. That's really the key. Push from D, I'm thinking now more up into the lumbars and spine. I'm starting to roll the spine in a way that really does bring the twist up into the lumbar spine. So here I'm lifting the whole pelvic girdle, counter-rotating it, and moving the ribcage towards me. And that's thinking again, the strong connection between hip mobility and low back comfort. Time to say a thing or two about hip replacements. People will come to you with hip replacements. People come to you because they want to avoid a hip replacement. People come to you because someone told them they need a hip replacement and never going to do it. But this is often the question I get from practitioners. Aren't these movements going to do this? Aren't they going to take it apart? Or even clients will be concerned about that. The answer is, well, it's theoretically possible. And if you want to know the safe protocol, it would be to first of all, follow what you were told as a patient, because your particular surgeon or orthopedist may have specific recommendations. But the general rules of thumb that seem to be reasonably consensual, for 6 months to a year after surgery, hip replacement patients are told to minimize or avoid abduction, internal rotation, hip flexion past 90 degrees. If it was a posterior hip replacement, I mean, if these days you were done in the UK, that's mostly what you get. Most other places in the English-speaking world, you get an anterior hip replacement where it's a different surgery, and they essentially take you through a different range of different possible, you know, they take your hip a different direction to do the replacement. And so it's essentially the opposite movements, abduction, external rotation, hip extension for anterior replacements. Now, I wanted you to have this information, but now I need to tell you that there's also, and I go into this a little bit in the Advanced Myofascial Techniques book, the trend is really toward not scaring people about their hip replacements. More than giving a big list of don'ts, it turned out that was maybe even more harmful than the motions themselves, that people would start holding themselves stiff or avoiding moving at all. And turns out that's a lot worse for you than these possible movements could be. It's a pretty low percentage of hip arthroses that actually do separate or have damage, pretty low, and it's getting better all the time. And I think it's something like this, the research that I quote in that volume one, I think it was 2/3 of surgeons, hip replacement surgeons, aren't giving any prohibitions to their patients anymore. And this was several years ago. They're saying that the prohibitions were more troublesome than the actual dislocations themselves. So there's, you know, lots of stories of people walking the same day, going to their yoga class a week later, et cetera, et cetera. Not that you should necessarily push it, but that you got to understand that these prohibitions by themselves can have an impact. I saw a hand go up from David. Claire, are you okay unmuting David and telling him when he's unmuted?
He's his hand has disappeared.
Hands back down. Okay.
Yeah. I'm here.
Oh, hi.
Go ahead, David.
Derek.
Derek.
Gil, hi, good to see you. You're all replaced with shoulders, hips, elbows, whatever. You find that the case that you can manipulate the body and the muscles and the structure?
Define manipulate.
Well, you're rotating everything.
Oh.
Where you're rotating the shoulders, the rotating the hip, the way you go into really trying to give someone, I always want to give someone a range of motion and have their body experience that subconsciously, it does wonders.
Yeah.
I'm always cautious when someone has a shoulder or a clavicle, or like you said, some of those rotations I do with the rotation of the hip joint.
Yeah, yeah. The shift that's happened in my thinking has been away from range of motion to range of possibilities. Yes. I know it sounds the same, but it turns out that range of possibilities is more of an experiential thing than a physical thing. Like sometimes it's a millimeter of rotation. And that's a lot more than it used to be. And that's amazing. You know what I mean? So it's the change. It's helping someone shift and change and allow another possibility that seems to be more therapeutic than just range of motion thing. Yeah. Okay. So it's. And with a replacement, I actually do think about possibility all the time. I'm thinking, how could it be okay for this person to allow another option? I'm not trying to get in there and loosen up the replacement, obviously. So it becomes less of a mechanical thing in that way, and more of a way of coaxing and helping them relate to that new joint in a way that leaves some possibilities there for them. And is less threatening overall. All right.
I was just trying to be cautious. I just don't want to hurt anyone. That's my main concern ever.
Exactly. Exactly. No, that is the most important thing. That's it.
Thanks.
Is David waiting? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I noticed in the positioning of the push brooms, both in the supplemental material and what you just showed us, that people's faces are out of their face cradle. Is that recommended for increased motion? Does having the face in the face cradle decrease the ability in your experience? I haven't taken one of the live courses and I haven't fully finished the supplemental material.
That's like personal preference and style. I personally hate face cradles.
Me too.
They kind of lock someone into that spot in that position. I'll tend to use pillows and bolster people up off the table so their head can be comfortable and mobile more than put them in a cradle. But there's people who do really effective work with cradles.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else before we move on?
Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, these domes of no abduction, external rotation, hip extension.
Yeah.
I would think when my mom had hip replacement and she did physical therapy, you know, the physical therapist and me as a massage therapist are going to want to, increase or maintain range of motion. So what degree of abduction is contraindicated? What degree of external rotation is contraindicated? What's the limit of degree if there is, or is it go by?
Yeah.
Is there a hard end?
Well, some of it's infield, and some of it is your relationship with your mom, you know? The answer is probably a complicated algorithm that combines those things into the research about what's the optimal range of motion. Research on optimal range of motion, by the way, is interesting, is typically done on young people. You know, there was the university undergrads who came in for the physical therapy graduate students research projects. That's where a lot of the typical ranges of motion parameters came from. And then, they found in a really sophisticated study, they'll take symptomatic people and compare them to asymptomatic and notice if there's a difference. But there's actually very few of those that have been done carefully enough for me to have much faith in range of motion measures. Let's put it that way. So I'm not looking to say how many degrees should it have. I'm looking to say, how can mom be happier? And how can mom shimmy a little more and boogie as she walks across the floor, you know, or sits in her chair or whatever, you know, she does? How can she have more options for movement? How can she expand her range a little bit and physical range, but also a range in what she allows? And then how can she have more proprioceptive refinement? How can she be friendlier to the sensations that she's experiences when she's using that hip? So I hope that's specific enough to be useful for you.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Pleasure. Okay, on with our show. I'm going to show you a surgery picture now of a hip replacement. Look away or whatever, because if you don't want to see it, it's definitely surgical in nature. This is a hip replacement surgery. This is a posterior replacement, not done so much in some parts of the world where it's set up for the anterior one, because it does involve cutting through more soft tissue. It's more efficient in some ways, but it does involve more soft tissue cutting to get to the hip joint. So here the hip joint has been cut open and the femoral head has been taken out and the titanium implant put in place. But you can see how even an anterior one, which is less invasive, there's a lot of soft tissue damage or effects that someone recovers from. And so we've been talking about the bony joint structure, so go out beyond that and think to soft tissue as we're thinking recovery and rehab. The getting layers sliding again, getting tissue sensitivity back to normal directions is also important as well. I'm going to go through these kind of quickly. They're basically just showing different zones of reference on the femur and on the acetabulum. What's interesting about this is that in different positions, there's loading on different parts of that socket ball arrangement. Different parts of that load differently. And that loading shifting around is part of what pumps the fluid in and out of this little groove. Like the movement we do and the center of pressure that shifts is essentially massaging and circulating this fluid within this joint. This little groove here in the acetabular foramen is how the fluids circulate and lubricate all of this high load joints. So we do, so anything your client does to a move is gonna help that. If they have hip joint issues or have been diagnosed with arthritis or concerned about that, this technique in particular, the iliofemoral and SI joint release, I'm stabilizing the knee, lifting the femur, putting some negative pressure into that joint by lifting the femur out of it. And that's, I'm thinking hydration at that point. I think I'm gonna just, let's do some fluid effects deep into that joint. And you can vary the angle and change things around and get a whole different bunch of different things there. Derek, I see your hand up. I'm going to get to you in a few minutes here. Ilium sacrum counter stretch. In this one, I'm doing a similar kind of effect at the sacrum where I'm using the leg to move the ilium in one direction and using my hand to move the sacrum in the opposite direction. So here is the skeleton view where by lifting the leg or using a firm bolster on it like a stack of towels and by keeping the low back long, I'm essentially torquing or torsioning that SI joint. Again, thinking hydration as much as anything else, pumping those fluids through it. Again, that which helps normalize the sensation and helps it be adaptable and all those kinds of things. Rotator technique, back to the picture, pressing it around that joint as I passively rotate the femur. I'm skipping over the descriptions here because I'm not gonna try to teach you this stuff on the call. You have resources where you can go learn that. I'm giving you the rationale and the principles behind it. The principles there is I'm holding it around the tendinous junctures around that femur and around the junctures where it joins into the pelvis itself. And by changing the tone, the resting tone and the movement, I'm evoking a Golgi tendon response perhaps, but certainly increasing the options of motion, helping that movement be friendlier to the person. Sacral tuberous ligament, such a powerful technique, such a powerful zone, so important to have someone understand why you're working here and to make sure that's really okay with them. But the sacral tuberous ligament is a massive structure deep in the pelvis that does stabilize and add spring to the base of the sacrum. Essentially, in this diagram here, it's showing how the weight of the upper body is rotating the sacrum or nutating the sacrum in a direction that's resisted by the sacral tuberous ligament. So if you imagine this is a springy ligament, that's what gives bounce to our step. That's part of what gives bounce to our step. as it essentially provides the shock absorption in that sacral movement from the weight of the upper body where it meets the pelvis. Finishing the sequence with some sort of calming technique or easing out of it. This is the one we use in our sequence to represent that stage of the work. It's the integration phase, as indicated by this little eye up in the corner, where in this is an old craniosacral one, face down client, feeling the shape change. It described a shape change in the sacrum. More often, rather than having the sacrum cupped and squeezing like it looks like I'm doing this picture, I'm overlapping my hands and feeling and listening for any sacral rocking. But then I allow the possibility that maybe it's doing this. That's what the osteopaths say it does, in a really slow way, that actually the sacrum changes shape. Why not? Certainly in the client's experience, it feels like their bones can change shape. And so I want to follow along with that. And this is a following technique. All right. So we're ready for Q&A. We're ready for any Q&A. I'm going to, before the end of the call, I'll go through and just catch you up on the home study and the next steps and such. But for now, let's check in. And Claire, I think I can do it now that I'm not screen sharing. So let me try unmuting Brandy. Go ahead, Brandy. You're unmuted. Do you have a question?
Brandy, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Go right ahead.
In the iliofemoral and SI joint release, where you're talking about sort of helping that head of the femur release from the joint a little bit.
Yeah.
In the other pictures, like the push broom pictures, you had talked about people are more comfortable when you push the hip or the femur past 90 degrees. I would assume in this picture, as it looks, you don't really want to go past 90, or does it matter?
Okay, so for the iliofemoral and SI joint technique, I think it's this one. I think it's A8 in the book. Is this the one you're asking about?
Yeah.
And yeah. You're asking, should that be past 90? That one I'll do at all different angles. Yeah, because I'm feeling into all different parts of the joint. Most people still are going to be more comfortable past 90. It's only my super flexible wife, who was the model for this picture, where it was easy to do it straight out, and that's how it ended up looking. That's what everyone's trying to do now at the table. Really, it's going to be more comfortable past 90.
Okay.
Thank you, Mandy. Let's see. Claire, you have not asked a question yet. Go ahead, Claire. You are unmuted, I think. I'll try it again.
Here we go. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I do hear you now, Claire.
Hi. I'm new to all this and enjoying it. Thank you. Do you assess for hypermobility of the SI joint before you do any of these techniques? I mean, I would imagine that the modification would have to be done. And then also, do you address strengthening where
Excellent questions. Yeah, no, thanks for bringing that in. Hypermobility is my personal, there's lots of definitions for it. My personal definition of it is motion that's causing problems.
Yeah? Agreed.
Some sort of problem that seems to be worse when it moves.
Correct.
And maybe it's a magnitude thing. You know, the hyper kind of implies that, but there's a debate. Maybe more motion isn't better in those cases. So do I assess for that? I don't check motion and say, okay, this moves a lot, it's hypermobile. I check sensitivity and say, is there a problem? You know? So if there's a problem, then yeah, I absolutely work with the problem that's presented. A problem being, say, pain or sensitivity. Yeah? If I do some of my tests and these techniques themselves or assessments as I go, if they elicit sacroiliac sensitivity, I work with that as sensitivity. If it was a movement restriction on there, I'm not thinking it moves too much. I'm thinking it moves too little. So then I will play with the edges of its movement, encourage more movement. If I wasn't pushing the movement restriction and it still hurt, then I'm thinking, okay, it's not about pushing more movement. It's about helping the sensitivity calm down.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not just physical, it's also experiential. It's like really where those meet. I do the physical assessment and then I'm tracking their sensation. Yeah. If it hurts, that's what I'm interested in. That's what the problem is. or if they're walking around and not, yeah, go ahead.
But is it necessarily always a case of removing some kind of restriction, or might it be a case where you need to help the person strengthen?
Two types of restrictions. One is, say, mechanical, where, yeah, there's just so, there's not a range that allows me to be happy there. The other type of restriction you could say would be protective, where there's a way that I'm stopping it from moving because I think it's going to hurt. And that becomes a self-reinforcing pattern. Both of those can be helped through manipulation or through strengthening. That's what your question's about. Strengthening works in lots of ways. The rationale, the simple rationale, is when you strengthen it, you reduce its range and make it more firm and more solid. Maybe. I think that's about as questionable as the idea that we can manipulate it and make it more mobile. They're both physical explanations for something that's more than just physical.
Well, both seem to increase awareness and both seem to add to experience. So
there you go.
Both would be applicable.
That's right. Absolutely. And honestly, my background and my bias is toward mobilization. And I'm not as good at strengthening just as a practitioner. I haven't had that, you know, focus. So a lot of my answers are going to be about mobilization, but strengthening is so important and using is so important. And if the mobilization doesn't help, then for sure add strengthening.
Thank you.
Kyra, you have not asked a question yet. I'm going to unmute you. Go ahead, Kyra.
Hey, it's Kira, but no
worries. Kira, sorry.
That's okay. So I'm interested actually in going back to the push broom techniques. I think I maybe saw them on AVMP like years and years ago. So now I'm remembering having tried them without taking a training. My biggest concern was my own body positioning. Mm. I've taken some structural integration seminars and worked with a lower and lower table. And now I find that unless I need that pressure, that sometimes it's way too low. So I'm interested to know how, at what level you work, because I feel like at a certain
point. How high is my table? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Because
with those techniques, if you're lifting from so low down, then that load is really lower back rather than.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. No, you got to watch that for sure. I'm not going to try to go find and show you that some of those pictures I showed you, I look at those now and I go, wow, okay. I don't want to look like that old guy with the cane because it really is about getting the right comfortable height for you. And I could get away with a lot more of that, 30 years ago than I can now. I still get away with some of it, but now I have an electric table. Honestly, now I go bzzz and get it to where it's comfortable for me. If I don't have that option, then I do get more creative. And that's something that I'm not even going to try to explain over a Zoom call. But that, that's really is, you got to work with it in your own body or get some ideas and input from somebody there in person. But that's a really good point, Kira. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okie dokie. Let's see. Brian, you're up again. Go ahead, Brian. I have you unmuted.
Yes. Two-part question. One, of all the ranges of motion, I would think that extension would be the most contraindicated because then it's putting more pressure on the SI joint, which we want to alleviate. So maybe getting our clients not to do quite as much of that because of the pressure it's putting on this SI joint and possibly the discs of the lumbar vertebra.
Yeah, I don't say that to my clients. Sorry.
No.
I mean, I don't say don't do that.
Okay.
There's one thing I tell my clients not to do. That is, don't say don't. Yeah. So I'm up for options for movement. I want every motion to be interesting. Now, like I said before, it might be 1 millimeter. But I don't want to reinforce the idea that their body's fragile or that they're going to break it or that there's things that they're going to hurt themselves with. I trust my clients' sense enough to not give them a bunch of don'ts. Yeah, and I know that not everyone feels that that's the way they work or important. Some people really do see it differently. I acknowledge that for sure. But in my own approach, I would say something, if I was concerned, I would say, explore gently. try different things, see what feels right. And also go by how you feel the next day. Don't just like how you feel in the moment. Take it slow, go bit by bit and see. Because that's the most honest answer I can really give too. You know, in my 30 plus years or whatever, you know, sometimes I can predict or guess, but most often it's still, gosh, you kind of got to try it and see how your body does.
And my second part of it was, we're going to assess passively to check joint capsule health and also actively to check muscle. So it's a two-part thing, correct, in assessing passive and active?
I think in at least in my personal style, I go back and forth. We'd have to have a technique probably to speak about it actually in that context. Often I'm using the techniques as an assessment too. I'm saying, what do I feel in terms of range and response, but also what am I evoking in terms of someone's relaxation or especially protection? And yeah, active and passive could be part of that. But it may not be, I'm not sure I'm answering exactly as you're asking, but yeah, that's probably a good study group question again about a specific technique when you find one. Thank you, Brian. Kate, I know I'm not going in the order you raised your hands, but I'm trying to get the people who haven't answered one yet. Kate Dimple, I have you unmuted. Please go ahead and ask your question.
Hi. Thank you for this. I have took the video class online and I primarily work with pregnant people.
Yeah.
And, you know, making exceptions for people that have true pubic symphysis dysfunction or and bolstering and all those things. I just wanted to get your thoughts on this type of sequence with pregnant bodies.
Mm-hmm. If you can solve the challenge of being face down,
yeah,
then I would say it could be really useful. Nikki or Lorene, anything you two, some of our faculty and assistants who have a lot of experience with moms. Nikki or Lorene, if you want to unmute yourself, or anything you want to contribute to that.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
You're on, Nikki, go.
Yeah, I actually find that I can do, it's not the exact broom technique, but in the sideline position, I can get at the rotators and a lot of the same goals. Mm-hmm. So using the book in this sequence with the same goals and just adapting in a sideline position.
Thank you, Nikki. Okay, I'm just noticing the time. I do want to try to end more or less on time, so I'm going to stop the questions here. I know that there's still some hands up, so I apologize that we don't have time for all the hands. For sure, write down your questions. Either go right now and write them in the Facebook forum, and I'll be able to answer them there, or bring them to your small groups. I am going to end the call on time, but I'm going to stay afterwards too to talk. So feel free to stay afterwards and talk about your questions then if you want. I got a couple last slides to show you as we wrap up. So the next step you're going to do now is go do the optional home study that involves watching the demonstrations now, the ones we've been talking about. They're on either the online video version or the DVD version of your pelvis, hip, and sacrum course. And you're gonna read the suggested chapter in Advanced Myofascial Techniques, Book 1. Again, these are, again, optional, but they will add more depth and background to what we've been talking about so far. In this one, the suggested chapter is Chapter 10, Hip Mobility. These, if you forget those two things, they are written in your handout. The last page in your handout has the list of home study. We'll also post this in the Facebook group, so it's there. If you ever forget what you're supposed to do, go look there, you'll find it. But then there's another one that I want to have you do, and this is maybe the key one. It says, invent, practice, and teach someone. I'm going to share my screen. Did I do that already? Sorry about that. Share my screen, which you can read along with me. There we go. Invent, practice, and teach someone else a self-care stretch, a yoga asana, a mobilization, or a dance move based on one of the A-sequence techniques. One of those things you heard me talk about today, or one of those things you find in the book or on the DVD, et cetera. Make something up, make a movement up, a self-care movement. Since a lot of you are not working with clients, but the vast majority of people are not working with clients now, you don't have a chance to go practice it as we would in most circumstances. So turn it into something for you. And then for extra credit, teach it to someone else. It turns out that that's the key thing that really helps you retain and get something is showing it to someone else. So get a buddy online and show them that way. If you got a housemate, show it to them. And you may have a chance, depending on your group leader, there may be a chance to share some of those when you get together in the small groups as well. Okay, so I know that there's still more questions such. I'm gonna open up only to faculty at this point. Only to faculty, I'm sorry for everybody else, but let's go ahead and check in with faculty. Anything else, faculty, you wanna say before we call the official meeting to a close? Going once, going twice. All right, let's do this. Faculty, would you just quickly unmute yourself, say your name, say goodbye so that people have a face when they go to your small groups. Go ahead.
Lovely to see you all today. I'm Laureen.
Fantastic.
Great to see you. I'm Nikki.
Bruce, you're on.
Great to be with you all.
Bethany, now Bruce.
Yep, great to see you all. This is really fun. Look forward to the small groups.
Chris.
Hey, Chris Mahowski here. Thank you, everyone.
Got him in.
great class and great to be here, part of this. Nos vemos en el grupo pequeño, los que hablemos español.
Yeah, still space in the Spanish language study group if you want a bilingual experience. Check it out. Larry, otherwise known as Lawrence.
Hey, this is Larry Coleha in Durham, North Carolina. We'll see everybody for the first small group meeting on Monday. Looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks, everybody. I know some of you got to go, so we'll go ahead and wrap up the call now. And again, Jay, if you have any questions, you know where to go. Facebook forum, that's the place to start, or email Tiffany. She's amazing. She'll help you out. And like I said, I'm going to stay on the call afterwards, but let's bow out. Go ahead and flex your hips and then bring them back to extension. And we'll see you all next week. Have fun in the meantime. Bye, everybody. Just quick exit if you got to go. Totally interested. We'll give you a minute for that to happen. Yeah, but some of you still have your hands up. That's good. I'll get through those too once we clear out people. I'm going to go ahead and mute everybody again. Great. I'm going to keep the recording going too, just so you're aware that we're going to keep the recording happening there. And yeah, focusing for those who are left, focusing on content questions. We can get into technical process questions later in the call, but let's stay with the content of the course. Laurie, you haven't asked a question yet. I have you unmuted, Laurie. Go ahead.
Hey, I didn't get, I'm not on Facebook. I'm not using it. I can get on it, but is there any other way I can get the small group info?
Yeah, that's that. Check your email. That was emailed out a few days ago. If you can't find it in the emails you've gotten from us, then just ping Tiffany. Just send her another email and say, "Hey, I can't find my small group info." But okay. It's just a link in an email, self-descriptive. I'm sorry, I don't have that right in front of you to tell you exactly what it says. But that'll give you the link. And I should say, now that you mentioned it, a bunch of those have booked up. And we weren't sure how much capacity to allow, and we're trying to adjust. I'm expecting there to be some cancellations and some things. So don't be discouraged if you go there and see that things are booked up. It's going to be different every time, and people will be canceling as they go too.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Nobody else's hand is up right now. That's really amazing. Cool. Yeah, if you can't figure out how to raise your hand and you have a question, go ahead and unmute yourself and ask your question. I just want to make sure we're not leaving someone out in the cold because they can't figure out how to raise their hand. All right, okay, Cynthia, go ahead. You're on, Cynthia.
Hi. Hi from Malta.
Hello from Malta. Hello, Malta.
So a quick question related to the strengthening that was mentioned earlier. So you mentioned that the Golgi tendon organs would relax the muscle. So how about waking it up when it needs stimulating, when it needs sort of the pre-strengthening phase, so to speak.
Yes.
How would you work around that?
How do I work around that? I have to, I don't work that way, basically, is a horrible answer. It's not very useful to you, except it helps you have a context for what I do say. What I think it's probably useful. I know that there are places in my own body that can use that and where I find that helpful to think about waking things up. Mm-hmm. But when people are on the table, that's not typically what I'm thinking of doing. Now, there are modalities that focus on that exclusively and do it really well. I'm thinking of my friend Jocelyn Olivier, who does a very sophisticated method of testing different motion directions and having people press into really nuanced different directions. And she does different points along the muscles to, in her model, wake them up. So
do
there's.
Do you have an idea what it's called or somewhere I can look? Because I work very much on the lines of relaxing and healing and releasing and all that stuff. But
yeah, Jocelyn. I'm lost. Olivier, she'd be one to check out. I'm sorry, I don't remember what she calls her modality, but I know she's active on Facebook and on the web as well, Jocelyn Olivier. Jocelyn. Yeah, and then. Or it might be Oliver. She might say the English pronunciation, Oliver. But there's lots of work. I mean, a lot of physical therapy works with getting people to activate certain chains of muscles and certain firing patterns. So there's a lot of in the rehab literature, and probably YouTube would be a great resource. You know, I'm sorry that my recommendation is that primitive, but it's really not my area of specialty. Probably there's people in our group that have an amazing amount of sophistication there and could give some really good advice. Larry's waving his hand. Go ahead, Larry, mute yourself and come on in if you want to say something. I was going to suggest, Cynthia, to put that question on the Facebook forum too, because I bet you'll get some really good responses there. But go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I do work with some of that with different people that have had constraints on or trauma where they have lost their range of motion and their muscle tone. And some of the tricks are to actually slowly get it moving again or find a movement they can do. And even if you're enabling it a little bit to help them find that new spot, that works really well. That stroke victims, you know, people that have been in a cast too long, all kinds of things. So any of those types of things, find it simple, keep them moving.
Larry, thank you, because I like your answer so much better. And that's actually true. That's what I do too in this technique. We're doing that all the time. It's not so overt as like Jocelyn's work. She's okay, this muscle's off, let me turn it on. But actually you're right, Larry. That is what we do when we do subtle movement or we ask people to actively participate in the work. That it doesn't have to be a big strengthening thing, that sometimes it's just waking, just finding it, finding the route back to that motion. That does the essentially reconnecting, turning up. We're doing that all the time. Connecting. Please, Cynthia, go ahead.
Thank you. No, yes, it's about that connection. I kind of wish that there was a Golgi tendon organ for stimulation. You know what I mean?
That's what muscle spindles do. Again, I hesitated to give that answer because I'm not a specialty in that model. I'm not using that narrative, like let's stimulate the spindle to turn on the muscle. I know there are kinds of work that do, like Jocelyn's work and other people's work. But I am doing what Larry says, which is what I'm thinking of, like, how can someone find this muscle through a process of my touch, our conversation, micro movements, experimentation, expanding awareness, embodying all those things is probably, in my book, even more interesting and more nuanced and maybe deep. And this affects some people to find it again.
Thank you. Thanks for everything.
Great question. Thanks for helping me improve my answers. Yeah, thank you too, Larry. Audrey, I'm going to unmute you. Go ahead, Audrey.
Hi, Till.
Hello.
Hey, and a partial answer to the last caller. I think the therapy that is done, and I haven't done it, but a friend of mine has trained it, is NKT.
Is that Jocelyn's work?
NKT, neurokinetic therapy, by doing muscle testing and seeing which muscles are strong and which muscles are weak.
Thank you. Yeah, you're out in the Bay Area, if I remember. And so, yeah, she's a Bay Area person. You probably are having that overlapping that same circle. That sounds like a good tip.
Yeah. My question is, we addressed the SI joint and the hip joint movement. Is there any relationship to two things, pubic symphysis, asymmetries, when one side is maybe higher, lower, whatever, does that have an effect on the entire pelvic girdle mobility? And the second thing is the same thing for scoliosis.
Good.
I just took your scoliosis workshop, by the way.
What would you predict my answer would be then?
Yes.
No, I'm going to say no, just for fun. I'm going to say actually position is something that I'm actually trying to tease apart from motion. So that a position or shape. So let's say, let's go back to scoliosis is a whole topic that, again, I'm more to say about that. But let's say pelvic position. Let's say you feel a pubic symphysis that's more prominent than the other side, let's say. Now, it could be because it's stuck anteriorly. That's the traditional explanation from an osteopathic point of view. Or it could be that it's a bigger bone on that side. Yeah, it could be that they're just shaped differently. And if you looked at a skeleton side by side, people are shaped so differently from each other. And it's rare that you see, you know, two sides of anybody's pelvis that are exactly the same. There's often some asymmetry. So I have, I'm a recovering symmetryaholic. Yeah, I'm trying to get myself to think beyond that. And I'm not saying symmetry is nothing. I'm not there. I'm not saying it doesn't matter at all. But I think there are some interesting times when it's a useful measure. But it's not where I'm starting. I'm not letting myself start there anymore. Because then I make too many assumptions if that's the first thing I assess and what I try to correct or treat. But what I will assess and what I will treat is the two things I said, mobility. Yeah. So if I find a pubic symphysis is different, I'll motion test it. And say, do both sides move? And if they move and there's no symptoms, it's not a problem I'm going to try to fix. Yeah. Because often my attempts to try to push them to the same level end up making someone less comfortable. If there's no problems to begin with, if there's no symptoms to begin with. In other words, making them symmetrical in an asymptomatic person is asking for trouble sometimes. Yeah. I think that's pretty much all I need to say about that. Unless you got a question, Audrey, to follow up. You're the last hand up in the room, so you can go longer if you want.
Nope, that's it. Thanks.
Okay. No, great question and an important one. And that's essentially the next level after this course, the ILIA and SI course. ILIA and SI course, yeah, SI joint course. That's what we go through, is that very question. How do we work with asymmetrical patterns in the pelvis, and how do we work with them as movement patterns? And a shape differences too. How do we crack that nut and solve that puzzle?
Right. And that's a new course, right?
Newer than this one, but it's been around for a while. In fact, it just came out on DVD. Yeah, it's the newest DVD. So in that sense,
yeah. I just got it at the last class. Thanks.
Thank you, Audrey. Brian, I'm going to unmute you. Go ahead, Brian. Try again, Brian.
I would love to see a list of your, like, take me into your office, fly on the wall, your assessments you do on people to see what's going on. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
To me,
the essential ones, I can reassure you, say the essential ones are built into those courses. I mean, the ones that I probably always use are the ones that have the most direct connection to that, the goals of that session. Are in there, but no, you're right. There's a whole toolbox of different assessments and different rituals we each have. Each of the teachers, you know, each of these people have, and all of the practitioners in the group, but I know my faculty has an amazing repertory of assessments they do to help narrow down what they're gonna work on.
Because I've learned just the better you are at assessing, then you're not running like, you're like, oh my God, what's going on here? You know what's going on. That's That's what I think I've worked on the most in the last few years is being better at assessing.
Yep. Yeah, so important. My goal for myself in the teaching, at least, is to really demystify that, because there is a very high level, sophisticated process of evoking the focus of the session in conversation with the client. But that makes it sound harder than it needs to be. That it often is very simple. It's often helping zero in on what is most interesting today within the context that I'm working in. So it isn't just like, where's it hurt? Let me press there. It's not that simple. But it really is staying directly connected to the client's experience, what they want, what their goals are, and then putting that in the context of what I'm working towards too.
Asking better questions.
Asking questions, listening, and then listening to the nonverbals as well as we go. Because the changes and responses you get in your client let you know if you're on track or not, honestly. And here's the technique. It's called trial and error. You make a hypothesis, or maybe it's testing your hypothesis. You make a hypothesis, you try it out, and you see how it's going. And does it seem like it's going good to me? Does it seem like it's going good to you? Great, let's continue. And if not, then we course correct. But thanks. Yeah, keep asking too. Thank you, Brian. Okay, that's it, looks like. Again, letting the faculty have the last word. Bethany, Bruce, Chris, if any of you want to add in at all, please feel free to just unmute yourself and go right ahead. Laureen, et cetera, I'm sure I'm missing someone. Carmen, as well as the interns. Pat's in the room still. Who else is in the room? Jessica's probably here. Okay, well, heck, no news is good news. Thank you all. Thank you all for that today. Let's, thank each other for the time here. Give a wave, give a bow, give a thumbs up, give us a polite sign. And we will see you all next time. Either see you in your small group, see you on the Facebook page, or email, or back here a week from now. Bye, everybody.